what is your view of that use of force during that time period?
Totally unnecessary.
What do you mean?
Well, first of all, pulling him down to the ground, face down, and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for. I saw no reason why the officers felt they were in danger, if that's what they felt, and that's what they would have to feel to be able to use that kind of force.
Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, the longest serving officer in the Minneapolis Police Department, saying that Derek Chauvin's response to George Floyd violated department protocol. Well, today wraps up the first week of testimony in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who allegedly killed George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. The trial began with testimony from bystanders who witnessed Floyd's death. They ranged from Donald Williams, a mixed martial arts fighter who was also presented as an expert on chokeholds, to an 18-year-old who made that video that was seen around the world when she recorded Floyd's death on her phone and posted it to social media. Prosecutors showed footage from the three other officers present, their body cams, replaying the events leading up to Floyd's death over and over for the jury. Here to recap the trial so far is Brant Williams, criminal justice and public safety correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio News. Hi, Brant.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also joining us with legal analysis is former criminal defense attorney Monique Presley. Hi, Monique.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you, too. Well, let's begin with you. This has been an emotional week on the stand, many people breaking down in tears in the witness stand. These were mostly bystanders, though. They didn't know George Floyd personally. Is that surprising to you as a longtime court watcher?
No, not at all. One of the things, if there could be anything that is a value in this process that we're having to go through, one of the things that's first on my list is an explanation of community and what community really means and the value of human life, where there are people around the world or even in our own country or in the state of Minnesota who may have never wanted to go to that neighborhood, who might not know anything about the people who are there. What you've witnessed in witness after witness coming forward and expressing guilt, expressing remorse, expressing regret, is the fact that they love the members of their own community and that every human life has value. And that has been on display the past 4 days and now 4.5 days of this trial.
Right. And Brant, I want to talk about one of the more emotional moments in the case. And this is when the young woman, she's 18 now, who made that video was called to the stand. And her name is Darnella. And she actually has survivor's guilt from making that video. And I just want to play a little clip of tape of Darnella on the stand this week.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more, not saving his life.
Brant, talk about that moment in the courtroom.
Right. As you mentioned, that was a particularly powerful bit of testimony. And of course, right after that last line, she pointed out that she said, but it was your responsibility to keep him safe. I think that was a reference to Derek Chauvin himself, who was sitting there in the courtroom. And this, I was not in the courtroom to see the jurors' response to that. We do have pool reporters who rotate in and out to get a sense of how jurors are taking this type of testimony. And what's been clear is jurors are paying attention. They are watching even the difficult to watch scenes from the video, from the body camera video that we were able to see, many of us for the first time, of the officers physically wrestling with George Floyd. You could hear his breath, his breathing a lot more closely. All that, I think, will probably have an impact on jurors. It'll just be a matter to see how it maybe sways them when it comes to deliberating after the trial testimony is done.
What have we learned this week from that additional body cam footage?
Well, the body camera footage, again, gave viewers a more up-close sense of that interaction between the officers and George Floyd, that initial contact with Officer Lane actually pulling his firearm out at George Floyd as he's approaching the car. You can see George Floyd's reaction, him being startled, him starting to plead with officers as they try to get him from his car and over to the squad car. It just gave, that extra angle on this confrontation, which most people had only seen through that bystander video. Mm-hmm. So we saw them walking him towards the car. And again, you're hearing this up close of George Floyd pleading and telling officers, I'm claustrophobic. I can't get in the car. I can't breathe. All these things, I think, came through very boldly in that video.
Right. And you also had the 911 dispatcher, Jenna Scurry, testifying. She's the one who dispatched the police in the first place after getting a call about a man with a counterfeit bill. And Monique, talk a little bit about her testimony, because she apparently was so alarmed because she could see video of what transpired during the arrest of George Floyd. She was so alarmed that she called the police on the police. How damaging is that to the defense's case?
I thought just right out of the gates that, and there, you know, that's the one thing that I would have to say about the prosecution in terms of strategy, in terms of placement and planning for witnesses. They didn't give us necessarily a chronological order, but they definitely gave an order in terms of relevance. And so from that witness, we're seeing through her eyes, because the cameras are on and she's watching this scene on the street, and she just knows that something is very wrong. She at one point says that she thought there was a glitch in the technical equipment and the video equipment, and that it was frozen, because in her mind, there was just no reason why these officers would be not just on the neck, but pressing down on the body of George Floyd for that long. And so, yes, she did. She flagged it and she reported to supervisors because everything in her was telling her that something was amiss. So here we have an experienced dispatch who is saying, this isn't right, and we need other eyes looking at what is happening. And that's not the only time during this trial we've heard. We also heard Donald Williams say that after it was all over, he believed he'd seen a murder and he had to call the police on the police because he did not feel safe reporting to any of the law enforcement personnel who were on the scene.
Well, speaking of Donald Williams, I want to talk about the exchange that he had with the defense attorney. He was a bystander, as you mentioned, who also happened to be a mixed martial arts fighter. So he was asked by the prosecution to also comment on the use of a chokehold. But it was during his cross-examination back and forth with the attorney for Derek Chauvin, Eric Nelson, that really got a lot of attention. And I just want to play a little bit of that right here. This is an exchange between the two of them where Nelson is basically implying that he incited Chauvin by calling him names.
You called him bogus.
I did.
You called him a bum at least 13 times.
That's what you counted in the video?
That's what I counted.
And that's what you got, 13.
So the two went back and forth. Clearly, Eric Nelson was trying to paint him as a quote-unquote angry black man, and Williams basically refused to be characterized that way. Can you talk about that exchange and whether or not you think that'll be important as the jurors deliberate? Monique?
I thought that was... just kind of a quintessential capturing of what black men in America go through, because on that stand, he was doing the best he possibly could to be clear, to be concise, to not be overly emotional, to tamp down on what you see as anger and rage from witness after witness who watched a man be killed. And so then with this defense counsel strategy, which I think is an error, because it's like they're not reading the room, they're not reading this case properly. Something is going wrong with their assessment, because these are witnesses who watched a man be killed. And that is something that very few people in the country or in the world actually witness in real time with their own eyes. And it is traumatizing. And so we're hearing about their trauma, and actually the manner in which they conducted themselves, including Donald Williams, was with restraint, considering what they were watching. And so I appreciated, and I believe that that jury appreciated, hearing Mr. Williams just respond and say, I am fully in my own body. I was in my own body. Yes, I was speaking, I was begging, I was pleading, but I was not inciting anything. And you heard the same from the firefighter, from Genevieve Hansen, that what they were trying to do was save a life, in essence. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about their anger for anger's sake. And by the way, police officers are supposed to be trained to deal with an upset crowd, to deal with armed people, to deal with someone having a panic attack, an anxiety attack, which is what it looks like Mr. Floyd was having, to deal with people shooting at them. They're still supposed to be able to do their jobs. In fact, that is the job.
Right. And so, Brant, is that generally the strategy on the part of the defense to try to paint the crowd as unruly, to paint a chaotic scene? And is that one of their strategies going forward, in addition to saying that George Floyd died from, you know, health complications and drug addiction instead necessarily from a homicide? That's the right. That's the two-pronged strategy, Brant?
Right. And in the opening statement, Eric Nelson basically said, look, he felt like Derek Chauvin was following his training as a police officer, that you act in a way to you assess, you do a threat assessment, you do a risk assessment, and you measure your actions by, you know, the type of threat that you perceive. And he was trying to bring this out during whenever he cross-examined some of these witnesses on scene. He would ask them if they'd actually been able to see around the car and see that there was a group of people that were actually starting to gather behind the officers. So it sounds like, you know, Eric Nelson is trying to – he's keeping that out there that, you know, officers are actually – or that Chauvin in particular was actually doing what he was trained to do, and that he was trying to control a situation. He was trying to keep Mr. Floyd from endangering anybody else, or keep making sure that the fellow officers that he was with were also not going to be in any danger. But as the other guest explained, it's falling on deaf ears, at least in the crowd of in the court of public opinion. Again, we'll have to see how the jurors take it, though.
All right. And how many more weeks is this trial expected to continue, Brant?
Well, they're saying it's going to go through the end of April, but of course, then once the jury gets the case, we don't know how long they'll take to deliberate.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much. Wrapping up week one of the Derek Chauvin trial, Brant Williams, criminal justice and public safety correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio News, and Monique Presley is a former criminal defense attorney and legal analyst. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Coming up, border crossings are at a 15-year high. We're going to talk about the immigration crisis next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the photos from the U.S.-Mexico border are striking. Children packed shoulder to shoulder in cramped rooms, separated by plastic sheeting and covering themselves with thin Mylar blankets to keep warm. Kids in cages all over again, to echo a common refrain from the Trump era. Trump shouldered a lot of blame for the conditions in those facilities. Well, now President Biden's critics say his immigration policies encourage migrants to surge toward the border. My next guest says these ebbs and flows have little to do with who is in the Oval Office and that the U.S. still doesn't have a coherent immigration policy, which is the main problem. Caitlin Dickerson joins me now. She's a longtime immigration reporter. She's at The Atlantic, and her latest article is called America's Immigration Amnesia. Welcome back to Press Play, Caitlin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, just this morning, Customs and Border Protection says more than 170,000 migrants, both adults and children, were apprehended just in March. And that's the most in 15 years. What do you make of that number?
It's certainly a large number of people, and it's striking for the American public to think about and try to imagine, right? You know, you've got boots on the ground border agents who are working around the clock to process people quickly and deal with the overcrowding that so many of us have seen in photos. There's no denying it. One of the points that I'm trying to make now, though, is that, you know, though that may be a 15-year record for the month of March, it's not the most migrants that Border Patrol agents have dealt with in any given month. There was, you know, in the year 2019, nearly a million people crossed the border in this way. So, you know, as somebody who's covered immigration for a long time, one of the things that I think is one of the biggest impacts of the Trump administration was drawing attention to, you know, the novel aspects of his immigration enforcement plan. Certainly, there was a lot that President Trump did that no other president had done before him. But even more so, it's drawing attention to issues that have existed for a really long time. So my story starts in 2012 when a surge that year began that peaked in 2014. There was another surge in 2016 and another one in 2019. I've covered all of them. And that's why maybe these numbers aren't as surprising to me as they are to people who are kind of hearing about this phenomenon for the first time now.
Right. And there is a lot of blame on the right, on President Biden, pointing to the fact that he did promise a more humane approach to immigration, which may be making it more attractive for people to make the journey and cross over in the hopes that they would be given more of a chance to make their case for asylum. Is there any credence to that?
I think there is. My point is not to say that President Biden's policies and his rhetoric have no impact on immigration. I don't think that's the case at all. But the reality is that research has shown, including government research, that there are a number of different factors that weigh into people's decisions about whether or not to come to the United States, and that American policy really is only one of them. Much more powerful, typically, is certainly the conditions that people are leaving behind. How bad is it at home, you know, to make people want to leave? Also things like weather. The desert, believe it or not, it's more hospitable now than it is in the hot summer months. And also, you know, the human trafficking industry, which is what most people rely on in order to be able to come to the United States. I do think we can absolutely believe that, you know, smugglers are going around Central America right now and saying to people, look, you've got to come to the United States now. Look, because Trump's not in office anymore, and you better hurry because who knows what's going to happen in 4 years. I mean, this is how these organizations work, and we know that. But to suggest that the entire reason for the surge we're seeing now is what President Biden has said since he took office, I don't think it makes sense, particularly because I mentioned the year 2019. That's 3 years into President Trump's hardline immigration agenda. That was the year that migration peaked under his presidency. And so it tells you that hardline rhetoric and even aggressive policies like family separation can only do so much to discourage migration.
Hmm. Well, given that this has been happening for a while, why is it that the facilities along the border are so ill-equipped to handle children and, in fact, large numbers of people? These children aren't supposed to be held in CBP facilities for longer than 72 hours, but they have been because there's just no space in other facilities run by HHS. But these facilities are not welcoming to children at all. These are the sort of, you know, kids in cages facilities. So why haven't they made those a little bit more humane, given that they know that this happens year after year?
So you're exactly right that there's so much overcrowding across the system, that kids are backing up at the border inside these facilities that were built, many of them in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. They look kind of like a cell inside of a local jail, almost what cops will call a drunk tank, where they hold somebody just overnight or for a few hours in a concrete cell, concrete floors, you know, maybe a concrete bench in there, with the goal of sending the person out within a few hours or a day at most. And now you have dozens and dozens of kids getting stuck inside them for days or weeks at a time. I think minor improvements have been made since the facilities were originally built, and that's important to point out. You know, there are precautions that are taken to try to prevent things like severe illness and death and people going without food and going without water. They're not always successful. And we heard of several deaths that took place inside these facilities while President Trump was in office. But for the most part, they have not been revamped. They haven't been changed dramatically. And your question is one that I have put now to three administrations. And I've said, if there's so much concern about the fact that the facilities and the people who are working in them aren't prepared to deal with these surges, why doesn't the government change the facilities when this keeps happening year after year? And what I've been told now by three administrations is that if they were to build massive, you know, comfortable, safe facilities that were intentionally built to house children, that that would send a message of welcoming to Central America and encourage even more migration. You know, the problem there is one that I already pointed out, that we know that a deterrent message is not enough to discourage people from coming to the United States alone. And so this fear that updating facilities in a way that might allow children to be more safe, it might not be warranted, and it might be resulting in this kind of really unnecessary problems with conditions that, you know, we're all looking at images and video of now.
Right. The other problem that you detail in the piece is there's only really one avenue for many of these immigrants to take, and that is to apply for asylum. Why can't they apply for a temporary visa under the H-2A program for farm workers?
Mm-hmm.
Are there just not enough visas available?
There are not enough visas available for farm work. Those visas are hard to obtain for the migrants trying to get access to them. And farmers will also tell you that they struggle to be able to, you know, navigate the government bureaucracy. So you're exactly right. You point out this problem where, you know, people fleeing Central America right now, according to research, including government research that has been done, they have experienced some of the things that are outlined under the current asylum procedures that would make them eligible for humanitarian protections. You know, it's very dangerous in Central America. Many people are living in deep poverty. Many people are fleeing gang violence. Many people are just fleeing the general government instability and corruption that exists there. But they're also coming to the United States, and they're eventually going to get a job and work. The problem is that there is no way for them to apply for a visa that actually reflects that reality. Our current laws that were updated most recently in 1996, they almost treat these two populations as if they're completely different sets of people, when of course that's not the case. Even if you're fleeing for humanitarian protections, you get a job when you get here. But we don't have an immigration system that creates visas for people who, you know, are considered to be low skill or lower education, who aren't independently wealthy. There are very, very limited options for them to be able to apply in a legal way from their home country. And so the only legal option is available is asylum. Our asylum laws say anybody can come to the American border at any time for any given reason, say that they need humanitarian protections, and that's a legal way to get access to the United States. And so that's the one that people are using because it's the only one they can use legally.
Caitlin, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Caitlin Dickerson from The Atlantic, where you can read her latest piece on immigration. Coming up, we'll check back in with a woman we met last year who had been living on the streets for years. Well, now she has her own apartment.
I didn't think this day was coming, truthfully. I didn't think so. It just seemed like, I don't know, like it wasn't going to happen.
The story of Christine, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, last year we aired a four-part series on the show called Samaritans. In it, KCRW reporter Anna Scott followed a woman named Christine Curtis. She'd been homeless for about 8 years, living on the streets in Mid-City, until a group of neighbors started working with Christine and called on the county to help get her housed. So for a whole year, Anna followed Christine as she tried to navigate LA's complicated homeless services program.
I was a little surprised that you picked me of all the people that are homeless. That surprised me. Although I think you were looking for somebody stable, right, that wasn't loco in the cabeza.
Over the course of 4 episodes, we heard how Christine was able to move from living on the streets into a group shelter in Hollywood. We also got an inside look into why it is so hard to get people housed in this city. Even after voters approved measures that earmarked hundreds of millions of dollars for homeless housing and services, Christine's story also ended on a hopeful note with a promise of permanent housing. Well, almost a year later, that promise has finally come through. Here's Anna with an update.
All right, welcome to my humble home. Well, here's the kitchen. It's got a gas stove and a gas oven. Mm-hmm. Right now, I want a steak so bad, a great big old steak, and I want a baked potato baked in the oven. That's what I want.
That's Christine Curtis. She's showing me around her new studio apartment in Koreatown. She moved in this week, a few hours before giving me this tour. This is a huge milestone, her first home after nearly a decade of homelessness.
The closet's kind of small, but I'll make do.
2 years ago, when I first met Christine and started interviewing her for this series, she was sleeping on a sidewalk in the Mid-City neighborhood. She wasn't receiving any social services and got by thanks to help from housed neighbors.
I mean, it's almost like, am I sure I'm not still asleep and I'm dreaming all of this? I mean, it'll sink in eventually, but not right this moment. It's not sinking in.
It's completely surreal, yeah. It is. The first time we met, I came out to see you, but you were asleep, so I came back later, and you were taking a nap
on
the sidewalk, right there in the sun.
Yes, I was.
Middle of the day.
That's right. That's right.
You just looked a lot different than you do now.
Well, I was a lot thinner, for one thing. No, I was sunburned terribly then, wasn't I? Yes.
Yes, you were.
Pretty badly. Yeah, pretty badly. I'm surprised my skin recovered as well as it did from the burns.
Yeah, you definitely look a lot healthier now.
Thank you. I didn't think this day was coming, truthfully. I didn't think so. It just seemed like, I don't know, like it wasn't going to happen.
You're listening to Samaritans, an update. I'm Anna Scott. For Christine to get to this point took a lot of help from housed friends she made while still on the street, at least 3 nonprofits, and being the subject of this podcast series. I'm not saying that opened any doors for her, but it may have helped keep things moving. This day is kind of a happy ending, except it's also a beginning.
The story begins when she moves in.
That's Sam Semberis. He hasn't worked with Christine, but he's a psychologist and president of Pathways Housing First, an organization that works around the country to provide housing and treatment to chronically homeless people.
She has spent, in the last 6-7 years, her life energy on survival, living outside, coping with this, coping with that. This is the first time now that she has the opportunity to think about what next.
Christine's new home has dark brown laminate floors, white walls, and 3 big windows. Right now, it's mostly empty, other than a bed, a dresser, and a small table with 2 chairs where we're sitting. Christine's belongings are stuffed into about a dozen reusable grocery bags on the floor. She says it could take her days to unpack.
I'll be glad when I do, but I'm not going to, like, just go full force into it all, like, oh, I got to get this all done today, because who's going to be checking on me to see that I have it done? Nobody.
Nobody checking on her. That's a new experience. Christine has never lived alone. She spent the last year before coming here in a group shelter in Hollywood and then in hotel rooms rented by local government, part of a city-county program called Project Roomkey to protect homeless people with medical conditions from COVID-19. Both the shelter and Project Roomkey had curfews and rules, like no visitors, and set meal times. Here, Christine can cook her own food for the first time in years.
I'm looking forward to that tremendously. And I'll have to see if my knife skills, because, you know, with this arthritis in my hands, it's been so long since I've actually used a knife. I'm going to have to go slow and see what I can do.
This new freedom is exciting and comes with new responsibility. Sitting at the table together, looking around at the mostly empty apartment, we make a list of all the things she needs. Hangers, towels, a shower curtain, cleaning supplies, trash cans. It's a long list.
A drip coffee maker, plates and cups and kitchen utensils, you know, that kind of stuff.
This building is specifically for people who used to be homeless. It's operated by a nonprofit affordable housing developer called A Community of Friends. Christine's rent is subsidized, which means she'll pay only a portion of it herself, about $55 a month, an amount based on her income. Right now, she receives about $220 a month in general relief from the county and about $180 a month in food stamps. This building has a case manager on site to help residents connect with social services, healthcare, and other resources they might need. Christine also still has a case manager with the nonprofit that found her this place. But nobody's holding her hand. This apartment didn't come stocked with household supplies. The mattress on the bed is still wrapped up in plastic. I asked Christine if she has any bedding.
No, I have no sheets. I have three small blankets, and one of them was one that Kim gave me. It's brand new. I never used it.
The blankets she's talking about were given to her back when she was still living on the street by a woman named Kim Moore. Kim lives in an apartment in the neighborhood where Christine was unhoused, Mid-City. Kim started bringing Christine food and other supplies years ago, and they became really close. Christine survived on the street with help from her friends. And it seems like she's still going to need that help now that she's housed. Christine hasn't seen Kim since the beginning of the pandemic. So we call Kim on my cell phone to tell her about the move-in.
Hello?
Kim, hi, it's Anna.
Hi, Anna.
I'm sitting with Christine in her apartment. Hi, honey.
Yeah, I finally made it, finally. I hope you can come over one of these days, hon.
Christine is incredibly fortunate to have any type of permanent, affordable housing. LA has a well-documented shortage of cheap apartments. What's less well-documented is even if you are one of the lucky ones to be matched with housing through LA's homeless services system, there's a huge bottleneck in actually moving into that housing. For Christine, that process took almost a year, which is typical.
All of this takes months and months and months for no actual reason.
That's Sam Semberis again.
You know, everyone in Los Angeles says, oh, there's no affordable housing. That's not true. I mean, it's true that there isn't enough, but there is certainly enough to house people like Christine and many, many thousands of others if the focus was on housing first and then paperwork later.
The Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, a city-county agency, announced plans last year to streamline the housing process and not let apartments with waiting tenants sit empty through months of cumbersome paperwork. The agency didn't respond to my questions about what's come of that effort. In Christine's case, a spokesperson for one of the nonprofits working with her, The People Concern, told me that the pandemic also slowed down her move-in, with different offices closed for different periods of time.
I wish I could have skipped the hotel and come straight over here from the shelter. That would have been great.
Yeah.
Whatever.
She's here now, though. And she says that on her drive over this morning, she got an unexpected glimpse at her past. She passed by the spot on Pico Boulevard where she used to spend her days and nights. She pointed it out to the nonprofit worker who was giving her a ride.
So I gave her the grand tour. We went by, you know, I showed her, I said, there's my McDonald's, there's the bench I used to sit on, and there's where I used to sleep. And I thought I would say, I miss this place. No. Almost like, thank God I'm not here anymore. But first, you know, I was missing it, but then when I went there, it was like, nah, this is the past. It's not the present, so. This is the present.
And inside this sunny studio apartment, she'll move into her future. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
You can hear the entire Samaritans podcast on Apple, Spotify, or whatever your favorite platform is. Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews. Dave White and Alonzo Duralde are here. Don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, it's getting warmer here in Los Angeles, but why go outside when you can stay inside and watch new movies? Here with some recommendations are Alonzo Duralde and Dave White, film critics for The Wrap and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Hello, happy spring.
Well, hello. Hi there.
Well, what says spring more than Godzilla versus Kong? I mean, really. Let's get a little bit from the trailer before we talk about it.
These are dangerous times. Godzilla's out there and he's hurting people and we don't know why.
There's something provoking him that we're not seeing here.
Who bows to who?
Nobody gonna stop for me.
Here we go.
Kong bows to no one.
Here we go.
Okay, Alonzo, why are mom and dad fighting?
Oh, you know how it is. You get two alphas in a room and it just the dinner party gets really ugly all of a sudden. there's a lot of crazy techno babble to explain the plot here, but it basically boils down to Godzilla is mad at a corporation that is doing an evil thing, and the corporation hires a couple of academic types played by Alexander Skarsgård and Rebecca Hall to get Kong to lead them to the ecosystem at the center of the Earth where all the monsters come from, because reasons, and it all leads to a big battle against the neon hued skyline of Hong Kong.
Oh my gosh, are we rooting for one over the other?
This is a firmly Team Godzilla house.
It really is,
frankly.
sorry, Kong.
and maybe that's why we were a little disappointed by this one, because Godzilla gets top billing, but this is a Kong movie. Like we really follow Kong plot, and Godzilla just sort of shows up to be an annoyance, and then you know a combatant, and that's kind of a letdown. So yeah, I was kind of disappointed, but I'm hearing you know out there in the world people are having fun with this movie, and so who am I to say don't have fun at a movie called Godzilla versus Kong?
Dave,
I agree with Alonzo. Any Godzilla movie, even one where Godzilla is at best a supporting character, is better than no Godzilla movie. So ultimately, because a Godzilla movie exists in the world right now and it's new, I'm content. It's not as good as the two most recent American-made Godzilla films. I'm fully in agreement with Alonzo. There's a surprise that I will not spoil, a very welcome surprise.
Yes.
But you know what? We're coming out of a pandemic. We all deserve some dumb pleasure. There's some dumb pleasure in this film.
Moving on. Speaking of spring, we have a movie with spring in the title, A Tale of Springtime. It's an Eric Rohmer oldie, and it's playing now at the Lemley Virtual Cinema. It's in French, so we'll skip the trailer. Dave, what is the plot here, and why is this being shown now?
Well, you know, it's from 1990, so that counts as an oldie these days. They have re-released, they've restored and re-released all four of Eric Rohmer's Tales of the Four Seasons. So here's the first one. It's about a 20-something woman named Jean. She's a philosophy teacher. She befriends another young woman named Natasha. Natasha lives with her divorced father. The divorced father has a girlfriend named Ev. Natasha hates Ev. And what follows is a trip to a country house where Natasha tries to engineer a situation where Dad dumps Ev for Jean, because that's what Natasha wants. So it's a comedy about fancy people with nice lives and classical educations who debate philosophical ideas over bread and cheese while simultaneously trying to refresh their existences. It's a tale of springtime, after all, with, you know, new lovers and friendships. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 110 minutes of nonstop talking. It is absolutely elitist filmmaking. It's not difficult, formally challenging.
You're really selling it, Dave.
Well, you know, you have to say that about Eric Rohmer because of who he was. He was a guy who changed his name so that his mother wouldn't find out he was a filmmaker, lest she die from the shame of it all. Yeah. You know, he's a person who thought that only Europeans could make good movies. You know, when you learn these things about a now deceased filmmaker, it does reframe the film you were watching. This film that you've seen before, maybe that you love Eric Rohmer films if you're a fan of French cinema, and you have to learn to sit with the discomfort now of knowing just who this person was personally and how it informed his filmmaking.
Alonzo, did you love hate it as much as Dave?
I think that Rohmer has made a lot of really great films. I did a series of introductions for Filmstruck back when that was a thing about his movies. And I'm excited about this restoration of the Tales of the Four Seasons because I think some of the films that are in this series are among his best work. Tale of Summer, Tale of Autumn are really great. Weirdly enough, I like Tale of Springtime, but I kind of think it's the weakest of the four. So I would say, with the caveat, if you haven't seen a lot of Eric Rohmer, or maybe this is your introduction to his work, maybe start with one of the other ones and come back to Springtime, because this one maybe doesn't give you the best notion of what he's capable of as a filmmaker. But if you are a Rohmer fan, I think this is the first time this film has ever gotten a U.S. release. I know Tale of Autumn has never been released in the States. Summer only came out here for the first time in the last 5 years or so. So this is sort of a rediscovery going on for American viewers of a guy who was a key member of the French New Wave and, you know, a very influential and talented filmmaker, albeit, you know, one with a problematic past.
And can you see all four at the Lemley Virtual Cinema?
Yes, they're opening sequentially. So this week is Springtime, next week is Summer, the following week is Autumn, and the next week is Winter.
Okay. Next up, a horror film called The Unholy. It stars Jeffrey Dean Morgan as a journalist looking into a supposed miracle performed by none other than the Virgin Mary. And here's a bit from the trailer.
The Vatican's been tasked to investigate this visitation from the Blessed Virgin.
I have read several libraries worth on the supernatural. Prove them all false.
She's here.
This is not the work of
the Virgin Mary.
It's the work of the unholy.
Ooh, okay. So, Alonzo, a deaf young woman is visited by the Virgin. Suddenly she can hear, speak, and heal people, but maybe it's not the work of the Virgin after all.
Well, she's visited by Mary. And she keeps telling people that she is working for Mary and that she feels the presence of Mary and they should devote themselves to Mary. And it's a good idea, I think, in these situations to ask, which Mary are we talking about?
Obviously, if it's Mary Tyler Moore, then you're fully permitted to go ahead.
Yes, Mary Astor. There are a lot of different ones that for sure you should trust. But yeah, it turns out this Mary is actually a 19th century witch who had been nailed to a tree, burned to the stake, and her soul was trapped inside of what they call a Kern doll. And then Jeffrey Dean Morgan's character sort of cavalierly smashes said doll and causes all of this problem to happen. This is one of those movies where we're meant to think that, you know, people who burned witches at the stake were right because witches were real. And so that kind of flies in the face of history, where usually the people doing that were just misogynists. And this is also the kind of movie where Catholic priests are superheroes and are the only ones who can save us from mystical demonic forces. It is the directorial debut of a guy named Evan Spiliotopoulos, who is a veteran screenwriter of everything from, you know, direct to DVD animation sequels to action films and comedies. But, you know, Sam Raimi is the producer here, and you kind of keep thinking about how much better this movie would have been if Sam Raimi had directed it. It just feels sort of perfunctory, and it wastes a very talented cast that includes not just Jeffrey Dean Morgan, but also Katie Hazelton, Carrie Elwes, William Sadler, and a very talented newcomer named Cricket Brown, who plays the possessed woman. It's her first movie, I think, and she's quite good. The movie is just kind of forgettable.
Dave, did you forget about it already?
What movie are we talking about?
Guess that's an affirmative, yes.
What I love about a movie like this is that it's built on a world where it's clearly a fact of science that evil spirits can be exorcised out of a person trapped in a doll because ceramic toys are more powerful than the entirety of the devil himself. Then it's also understood that you can only pray to it twice, not three times, because it's kind of like Candyman, before it turns the entire town into a demonic sinkhole.
Okay, let's move on. Our last movie of the day is Concrete Cowboy. It stars Idris Elba, whose estranged, rebellious son comes to stay with him for the summer. And Idris introduces his son to the world of urban horseback riding. Here is a bit from the trailer.
The history here is deep. We like the Wild West out here.
Yo, what are you doing?
You want to ride the street life? You can't be in my house.
What's going on?
The city decide they don't need horses no more.
They can't take who we are as a people.
So what are we going to do then?
We're going to do what we always do. We're going to ride.
Okay, Dave, this takes place in Philadelphia based on a young adult novel called Ghetto Cowboy. And
yes.
Is this a father-son bromance plot here?
It's the story about a father and son reconnecting. The boy is played by Caleb McLaughlin from Stranger Things, sent for the summer to live with the father he doesn't really know. The father's played by Idris Elba. The father keeps and trains horses. He's part of a group of black horse riders based on real groups in Philadelphia, one called the Fletcher Street Urban Riding Club, another one called the Black Cowboys Association. Now, the kid is skeptical of all of this at first. He wants no part, but he slowly comes to grow close to one of the horses and then ultimately to his father. And he gains a sense of belonging that he had not felt before. It's a kind of overtly inspirational film, very confidently mainstream in its approach. It's also very, very moving. Really solid performances by Idris Elba and Lorraine Toussaint, and especially Caleb McLaughlin as the troubled teenage kid. There's some really wonderful, tender, emotional moments between McLaughlin and Elba that might choke you up. And, you know, there are some dialogue that feels quite like dialogue or inspirational message sort of dialogue, but you'll get over that quickly. It's really lovely, but this is also just a lovely story of family reconnecting and learning to love each other.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm down for that. Alonzo?
In the film, The Opposite of Sex, Christina Ricci in the narration makes a joke about the summer that changed everything movies. And this is very firmly a the summer that changed everything movie, but it's so good you don't mind. It's like Dave said, there's some corny aspects to it. And we've seen a lot of these tropes before, but this is so just genuinely emotional and really well acted. I also want to shout out Jarrell Jerome from When They See Us, who plays kind of what I call the Robert De Niro in Mean Streets character, you know, the guy who's living on the streets and you know he's doomed, but he's flashy and charismatic and you know, it's a great performance and I really enjoyed it. But yeah, uniformly the cast is great, including people that you don't find out until the closing credits are actual members of this horse culture in Philadelphia.
Yeah,
and they interact with the sort of professional actors very smoothly. So it's not really till the end. It's kind of like Richard Linklater's Bernie, you don't know until the closing credits who's an actor and who's a, you know,
someone who lived in the town.
Yeah, yeah, someone who actually is from Philadelphia, has the horses, like is involved in this world.
Okay. Horses, Godzilla, Kong. We have a lot of movies involving the animal species to look forward to. I don't know, animals necessarily. Godzilla and Kong.
One real kind of animal, two fake kinds of animals.
Yes.
But all have a place in our hearts. Alonzo Giraldi and Dave White, film critics for The Wrap and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that does it for us this week on Press Play. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, and Bennett Purser. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. Have a great weekend. Stay well, stay safe, stay happy. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.